Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans. We are joined today by my esteemed colleague and co-founder, William Gatsby-Pete. Welcome to the pod, Will.
Hey, team. How's it going?
And we are joined today by Charlotte Clark, who is a startup journey pioneer, first ever startup journey pioneer we've had on the podcast, and is doing some great work with an organization called Base Ventures, which we'll hear a little bit about later. Welcome to the pod, Charlotte.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As always, with Tech Can't Save Us, we're going to jump right into the headlines. And we shared a couple articles with Charlotte and team before. The first is about the digital divide. And obviously, that's a major problem in terms of equity and access for people in the broader community. So I was just curious, Charlotte, your take on how the digital divide affects the startup community, the startup ecosystem, in your view.
I think that the main thing is realizing that not everyone has access to technology. I think sometimes with the assumption of customers and what problem you're solving is that the immediate answer is, oh, like, let's build a software platform for that. But depending on what type of people you're hoping to target or people you're hoping that are going to buy your software, you got to make sure that they, you know, have internet and can access your platform. I think that that's super important. The only other thing I would say is that with startups and products specifically, a lot of those interactions don't have to just be software. They can really be human interaction and talking to people and things like that. And so with the divide that's happening and with everything kind of moving more online, I think there still needs to be some human-human interaction that kind of comes into place as well.
The article we're talking about is something we shared from Wired magazine, you know, focused on, you know, basically the title of the article is "The Digital Divide is Coming for You," pretty ominous title. But one thing that struck me during the lockdown was, at least living in the UK, the number of services that are now online, specifically like the NHS app, and having to access, you know, the NHS app to prove your vaccination status, to be able to travel in many ways. So that was sort of jarring to me in terms of like, okay, who has a smartphone, who doesn't, who has, you know, a data plan that they can just pull this, you know, information down if they're in transit or needing to go somewhere. I just remember sort of thinking to myself, like, this feels like the digital divide in practice almost, or, you know, that's happening. Curious to hear your thoughts on that.
As someone who has been in the tech industry for a while, like, I still do a lot of things manually. Like, I refuse to have my plane ticket on my phone because I'm afraid that, like, my phone's going to die and I'm not going to get on the plane. So I always print it out. It's like things like that where I'm having the option to, like, step out of the digital world is great. But when you don't have that option any longer, it kind of, you know, makes things a little bit, I think there's like more factors to consider, like keeping your phone charged all the time, or, you know, actually having a phone that has data plan and making sure that you have the best data plan available. I know I've been in situations where the internet doesn't work and, you know, you're trying to download something and it's taken forever. Now there's, I think, more considerations as far as like, is your internet going to be able to download full file and things like that, that I don't know that everyone has thought about too far.
I think as well, the examples we're talking about are quite, you know, everyday ones where it is an assumption that everyone has a smartphone, but, you know, it's a less bad assumption than in that particular piece where it talks about, like, you know, I think it's way worse from the business side of things. You know, it's hey, so you're a junior SEO on a junior SEO salary, we expect you to have familiarity with, you know, $2,000 a month's worth of software. And, you know, so there's an element kind of for the mass market. But I actually think the problem's much more pronounced for the B2B side of things, you know, where you're hiring team members and it's just an assumption that, oh, well, you must have X, Y, and Z tech products. You know, you must have about $2,000 to $3,000's worth of hardware to run all of this stuff we're doing. Cause, you know, like, if your laptop isn't up to a certain spec, it's just not going to be able to run some of this heavy going software. I don't know how anyone gets into design, given how much everything costs to do with design. You know, even us as an agency, we sometimes are like, ooh, £400 a month, that's a bit spicy for this bit of software. And, you know, it's our bread and butter. It's what we do for a living. So if you're a junior 21-year-old getting started out in a career, I think it really is a big divide that doesn't get enough coverage.
Team is moving here, and another related divide. We shared an article about the divide in the startup ecosystem between, you know, China, the United States, and Europe. And some of the stuff I'm reading about this, the EU, European Commission, is looking to invest about $3 billion directly into startups over the next 7 years. There's some stats floating around out there about how venture capital in Europe is estimated to be about 50 years behind the United States. And there's, you know, a lack of significant support from institutional investors, such as like pension funds, for example. The European Commission is trying to get ahead of this and say, look, you know, some folks in these regions, founders in these regions enjoy up to four times the amount of homegrown capital and much higher valuation in that early stage startup ecosystem. So Charlotte, would love to hear your thoughts on the European Commission's plan to level the playing field.
I think it's really interesting. I've done a little bit of research into startup ecosystems and learning more about, you know, what makes an ecosystem great and what are some of those factors that, you know, are able, I guess, to kind of predict whether or not large groups of startups are going to be successful. And one of the things I realized was that it's very much like city specific. So it's really interesting to think about how the European Commission, you know, is a blanket over very many cities and very many countries are hoping that like putting resources into the same areas will help to kind of grow and accelerate startups that among, you know, many different landscapes that money might not, you can't necessarily inject it into one thing and hope that across the board, you know, everything kind of accelerates in the same speed or in the same like difficulty level, I guess. So that was probably the biggest thing that I kind of took away from that is thinking a lot about that. Like, there's so many other factors that are in play. And I'm assuming there's also like regional weather and, you know, types of people who, you know, necessarily migrate or grow up in those cities that also kind of helped it determine whether or not innovation and startups, you know, can grow and thrive in those places.
And has most of your work been focused on US-based startups, Charlotte, or have you worked with any?
The work I've done a lot has been with early stage startups, mostly in the United States. But when I was consulting, I had some startups that were from Europe and actually all over the world, a couple of people in Africa. I was always like, from the lens of someone who's in the United States, this is kind of what that landscape is. But a lot of what we were talking about wasn't necessarily like, these startups were very much early stage. So they really weren't thinking too much about venture capital and growth and some of that stuff that I think also can really vary across cities and across countries. Whereas some of the early stage, like, does my idea make sense? Can I develop a product? I think all of those things are pretty universal.
And Will, be curious to get your perspective as the resident European on the call. You know, just we've obviously worked with clients in the US and the EU and UK, you know, here at Literal Humans, but you've done some other work as well. But just, yeah, what's your take on the divide, as it were?
Yeah, I think VC funding is fundamentally broken across the world. What I find really interesting in the conversations we've had with our friend Chris over at Sifted is everyone in VC land thinks that too. You know, they have more money than they can invest. They know that they're missing opportunities every week of great startups. They know that they have a problem with equity. They know that they do not fund enough minority-owned startups, and they just can't fix the problem. I think it's, in terms of sectors, probably one of the ones that is due a revolution in terms of some form of democratization of the funding. Because, you know, everyone on both sides of the divide wants to fix it and for some reason can't. VCs want to be giving more money because then they get better returns and then they grow more businesses. You know, people who have a vision and a dream want to get funding to build that dream out. With both sides, you know, it just feels like at some point someone's going to come up with some form of smart, you know, platform or system. You know, in some regards, that is what Sifted is trying to do. But yeah, it does feel like a problem ripe for a solution when everyone's on the same side and just needs a bit of a spark, I guess, to catalyze it.
What about this notion that like direct funding from government or intergovernmental institution like the European Commission will stifle investment and innovation? That's an argument that's been made by some folks in the venture capital community and some folks in the broader startup ecosystem. What do you all make of that argument?
I think it's really interesting because I think from the perspective of like venture, like not everybody applies to venture capital, you know, there's like very certain startups that are ripe for the opportunity in which venture capitalists can then invest and get crazy returns. And I think that there's a lot of education that's kind of missing and some of that, like, are you actually a venture backable business? And are you someone who maybe should be thinking more about sustainability and creating a revenue model that makes the most sense for you? So I think in that kind of vein, like maybe those who are venture backable turning away from venture might be a problem. But I think that that's such a small percentage of companies that for the rest of them that, you know, might have tried to pitch to a VC and or, you know, haven't really gotten any traction in that space can then turn to other modes of funding and get the funds that they need and are able to really move forward and not have the VC kind of be the gate that keeps them from success and from generating revenue.
I think as well, like anytime a VC tells you it's going to stifle growth because those guys don't know how to invest, there's always an element of like, are you maybe a little bit of a biased opinion here? Like,
yeah, definitely. I think that it's really interesting to hear, you know, VCs who are making trends like that or, you know, speaking about startups that they funded and startups that they haven't funded in. And I just feel like there's just like a large enough education gap for those founders who are thinking about capital raise. And even I know that there are some founders who have pitched to investors and got rejections and, you know, are really taking the feedback to heart, but thinking about the feedback in the lens of a VC versus like feedback in the lens of, you know, a greater startup ecosystem, like things are a little bit different, you know, especially because VCs are hoping that you're going to 10x, 100x their money. And so that from that lens is like a very different feedback loop than, you know, will your business succeed in generating revenue, in hitting large customers and solving customer problems? Some of that is a little bit more nuanced.
And just to keep the conversation going, a last piece that I'll share with you all, just about startup founders. And this is one of the questions we mentioned to you in the prep here, Charlotte, about, you know, the news cycle. And obviously this is a piece of relevant news and, you know, what's going on with the startup ecosystem. But be curious your take on startup founders and how they relate to the news cycle. You know, what have you seen in your work in terms of, like, where do you see startup leaders going wrong and going right, I guess, when reacting to the news?
I'm a little bit biased because I don't necessarily react to news sources at all. And so I have a probably very limited view because I'm not looking at news. I'm not looking at people reacting to news. But I think that sometimes, depending on what the news is, it can kind of be like a distraction from, you know, what is your core value? What are you trying to really build for? And I think that in other cases, you know, with Supreme Court, for example, some of those things, like I think that is a great way to kind of help realign values and really think about, like, as we start to hire more and more people, you know, what is going to really matter to the people we're bringing on and kind of creating great culture kind of around some of that. So I think that that's kind of where the discernment kind of comes in, is that not all news is something you need to necessarily react to, but I think that some of it can really provide kind of a lens of like, okay, like as a company, are we poised to, you know, think about all people's best interests? So I think that that's a really great way to have the news cycle kind of incorporate into your business. It's maybe sort of a long-term, how do we put our best foot forward versus how do we react to the news, you know, right now in this very much isolated space?
Yeah, I appreciated the piece in the SIFS article about startup founders reacting to the news cycle. There's an element in there where they talked about, you know, linking your core company values to real world actions. We don't, unfortunately, at the moment have full-time employees who are based in the United States at the current moment. But obviously, when the recent decision came down from the Supreme Court, I thought to myself, how can we as a company, you know, support reproductive freedom, reproductive rights for future employees that we may hire who are based in the United States? That's like a real world action that we can take. That is, it's not monumental and it's only going to affect, hopefully, you know, a few people. But that was something that I see founders out there struggling with, of, do I speak out? Do I take an internal action? Things like that.
Yeah, I do think that it just comes down to, do you have anything insightful to add to the conversation, you know, or do you feel very strongly about it? There's nothing worse than when you see like, hey, here's company X's view on topic Y. And it's like, I don't care about my Wi-Fi provider telling me how they feel about the war in Ukraine. Like, you know, like, fair enough, if you've done a lot to fix the problem and you've made meaningful strides, you know, Ahrefs did an incredible gesture where they gave free trials away. And they donated the trial fee to the war in Ukraine. That's a real actionable thing. But just being like, hey, here is a 400-word post on Ahrefs' view of the war in Ukraine. It's like, come on, man, you know, no one cares about that. Like, you know, it has to be part of your company soul and DNA. Otherwise, don't do it. I think people see stuff going viral on LinkedIn. They get enticed by that and they don't realize the reason it's gone viral is like, yeah, well, that person's talking about that topic because they live and breathe it. And their company is literally dedicated to solving that problem. That's why it's gone viral, because they've offered genuine insight and, you know, contribution towards that conversation.
Yeah, I think it brings up a bigger question about kind of thought leadership and like what you said, William, about like if this is something that's like core to your business and your values, like definitely speak up about it. But if it is just something that is zipping by you and you're like, ooh, I gotta react to that, like that might not be the best course of action for you.
Thank you.
Well, keep us moving. I want to shift us to you, Charlotte, to all things startup ecosystem journeys related. One of the questions we have for you is just around how you got your start. So, I mean, you call yourself a startup nerd, quote unquote, and we just wanted to know, you know, what influenced your interest and your curiosity about the startup world, what your journey has been to date.
I initially was a software engineer in a large healthcare company, had like no background or awareness of startups, which is really interesting to think about now. But in 2020, I was trying to transition into product management and had decided that instead of trying to find a job that was like, didn't have any experience, I was going to kind of create my own business and kind of come at it from that angle. What I was really trying to do was really tie in my technical background. Part of what I was having a lot of trouble with was thinking about being client facing and having a technical background and having those two marry. And although product management did kind of help with that, still it was kind of like, who was my client? Who was my customer who could, you know, get the most value from that? So I actually joined a business incubator for the consulting business I did create. Initially, it was going to be for entrepreneurs who are building businesses and aren't thinking about like automating process, which was a good idea. But I had a mentor who was part of that incubator who was like, you know what, you should be working with startup founders. Like they really face a lot of technical issues that you're trying to solve. And I guess the general entrepreneur who is not trying to build a software platform might not have the right discernment for like, are your services for me or not? I mean, that was really kind of the catalyst. I kind of stumbled into it. But from that point, I kind of shifted into the consulting business being about fractional CTO work, knowing that a lot of non-technical founders spend a lot of money trying to build software and are really needing that person to kind of bridge technology and what is feasible in a tech space. And then in business strategy and business needs. And so that was really why I kind of created this understanding about like, now I have a technical background, I can talk to business people and start to dig and delve deeper into startups. And from that point, it had really just been about startups and product development and, you know, how do I teach founders more about product? A lot of founders don't know what product management is. So it was a lot of like, okay, well, if you're a founder, you also need to do product management. And what kind of pieces of that can you tie into what you're doing day to day that is not hiring engineers? Because early stage founders don't necessarily have the funds. So that's really how it started. And as I was talking to more and more founders, I was starting to see more trends that were kind of went beyond, you know, can I build this product? And some of it was founders who kind of stopped everything they're doing because someone has told them they need a technical co-founder. And so they're searching for someone to bring on. That, from my perspective, felt like something that's not totally feasible, knowing how many technical people are in the world and how many technical people have business strategy and business acumen, that number kind of shrinks. And so then I started to really think a lot more about a lot of the other kind of problems that are faced or founders that are facing these types of problems that are almost not just hurdles, but kind of like stop all work in progress, and really understanding like what is it like a deal breaker in your startup journey versus something that you just kind of have to figure out how to maneuver around. And from that point last year, about this time, I was working for a startup and the startup went to fundraise. And then I was kind of like out in the space, like, what am I doing? Where do I get income? And then I joined an accelerator as a program manager. And that really opened my eyes up to all the other things that founders are doing. I was there part program manager, part kind of advising and product development still, but was talking to founders who were seed to series A, and they still had similar founder, how do you transition to CEO issues? Am I hiring the right type of talent? Am I thinking about my product in the right way? And from that point, I think it started to really expand from, you know, founders who have early stage product development problems to founders who don't know what's going on and are trying to learn things and are trying to hire the right people and are just dealing with so many different things that it started to become not just a founder issue, but like an ecosystem issue. So worked a little bit now with UMKC's Innovation Center, which is, I like to call that like entrepreneur hub in Kansas City. And they do a lot of work with all entrepreneurs, and there's a tech venture studio that works a lot with startups, but really seeing from like that entrepreneur startup support organization view of like, you see all of these founders, you're trying to help them, and now you're trying to throw resources at them, and really thinking a large scale about not just helping a founder one-to-one, but how do you help large groups of founders, you know, maneuver through the ecosystem and hit the right resources and get the right capital and help them launch and grow. And so that's really how it's kind of expanded now, to really think about all angles of some of that journey and how to make that journey as unique to the founder as possible, but also kind of standardize a lot of that work that they're doing, making sure that they're able to just be like, cool, I'm going to start a business. I know what I need to hit. I know there's going to be those roadblocks, but here's how I'm going to solve them and ultimately be successful.
I heard a lot of empathy in what you're saying for that founder's journey. I think, like, obviously you call yourself a startup, you know, journey pioneer. And, you know, we see that a lot working with different ventures. That just lots of founders like torn between, do I spend that marginal hour developing a product or doing marketing or raising money or whatever else, you know, founders are asked to do. So definitely appreciate that part of your work of just like figuring out where they are in their journey and providing them with resources and support. Sounds like you do a fair amount of coaching too. I'd love to hear more about that. Like, how has that been for you, like coaching founders? What are some of the big challenges you've seen founders run into as part of that coaching journey?
It's actually really funny. When I started consulting, and then last year I was doing Clubhouse talks, and I had a large volume of founders who were scheduling calls with me, and we would chat. And I had one founder who was like, "You're kind of like a therapist." And I was like, "Whoa, I don't know that I would." But I mean, I think there's a little bit of that of founders. And I think that where I was kind of sitting in the niche of early stage and you're building and you're thinking about things, that a lot of those founders are lost and they're like stressed. And, you know, they might find other people to talk to, and those people are either trying to pitch them on services or, you know, are almost, I don't know, kind of like trying to sell to them and pitch to them. And as I was consulting with a lot of these founders, I was just like listening to what they were saying. And I was like, hey, like, I think that you can do this. Like, this makes a lot of sense to me. I was telling a lot of founders who, you know, were like, oh, I'm looking for a tech co-founder and I haven't found anybody. I'd just be like, actually, I think you're probably technical enough to do this yourself. Like, I wouldn't worry about finding that person. And so that's kind of where I've realized now, I think in hindsight, that like a lot of that was just kind of empathizing with what they were dealing with and not just trying to sell them on my software and on my products and on my services, which is why I've kind of stepped away from consulting, is because I wasn't pitching enough people, but really hearing what they were saying and just being like, okay, well, like, here's what I know. And hopefully you can take some of this, and this can be kind of part of how you move forward and how you feel empowered as you move forward. And for me, it became less about like, let me have this person pay me to do things, and more about like, how do I make sure that you feel like you're good enough to be in this space, and that whatever you're building is useful, and whatever you're building, you know, every tiny step you could take gets you kind of closer and closer to that launch goal or that fundraise goal or that hiring goal.
We'd be curious to hear about your latest venture. I think it's called Base Ventures. It sounds like it's fairly new, and it's being lifted off the ground as we speak. So we'd love to hear more about that.
I'm really excited about this. Well, last year, actually, I had a founder ask me if I was going to become a founder. I was like, oh, no, that's not going to happen. And now being a co-founder and CTO of Base Ventures, kind of happenstance, as it were. But Base Ventures is kind of an umbrella company. I'm thinking about building tools for founders and for the ecosystem. And the first tool we're really working on right now is called Foresight, which was created in the mind of my co-founder, Janae Kamage. But from my perspective, being the CTO and being the person who's primarily trying to build the tool, I think about it as kind of that communication tool between founders and everyone else in the ecosystem. And I kind of touched on this a little bit about how, you know, founders have a lot coming at them, and they have a lot of misunderstanding, I think, around like, where am I at? Like, what am I building? You might know what you're building. You might know what your business strategy is, but founders really have a hard time articulating like, where are they in their journey? And this was something that I really dealt a lot with as a consultant, was like, we would communicate and I'd be like, cool, I think you're here. And then I'd get into their documents and we'd be discussing more. And then I'd start to realize that they were using words and terms that like they thought meant one thing, but like really means another thing. And so I think they're over here, but they're really like way over there. And so Foresight is really hopefully going to be that tool. It really helps to make sure that founders from any angle of wherever they're at, and whatever they're building, really provides kind of a standardization process of, we're taking in all of your information and we're giving you a score. And that score kind of quantifies where you are at in your journey. Is a score around, are you ready to launch? Are you ready to fundraise? are you ready to be, you know, talking to accelerators and talking to investors and getting certain resources that will kind of help to accelerate where you're at? So that's what we're building. The tool is right now questionnaire, really thinking about scoring and finding ways to best quantify founder strengths. And part of that founder journey really is the idea rooted into a problem and a solution. And then the third one is about readiness as far as, do you have all of the strategy in place to really take this business and start to pitch or start to launch? That's what we're kind of starting to build. It's really funny to think about product development and building it, but then having that visibility and awareness of like people like, oh, what are you building? And I can't find it. And it's been interesting to have spoken to so many founders, and now kind of being a founder myself feels very like meta in the way that it's like I talked to a lot of founders and now I am a founder and starting to really see more of what founders were telling me and kind of the journey that I'm on right now. And it's almost like I'm coaching myself in this like weird space. But yeah, it's really exciting.
One thing that comes up for me is like I've been through an accelerator, I've been a founder, you know, once now twice over, I guess at this point, but like the lack and maybe diffusion of institutional knowledge about like what it takes, like it's just, it seems like there's a lot of resources out there, but they're not well organized and founders are constantly having to reinvent the wheel in so many different ways. It's so silly, like in a sector that prides itself on like knowledge management and sort of, you know, different technical solutions for things and stuff to see that. So it sounds like the work you're doing with Foresight, you know, the first product and Base Ventures is going to be really impactful. So we're excited to see what comes on the back end of that.
Definitely. I'm really excited, especially because as someone who, again, does a lot of technology, what we're building, I think, is founder forward first and maybe technology second. Really what the biggest piece is kind of that algorithm. But thinking about building the algorithm is less about what is the technology going to be and more about like, how do we best score this? That's really been the most exciting piece of this is like, I'm like, okay, like once we kind of figure out what the algorithm is, the software and how we build it into software and how we scale it is like the secondary piece. And that part feels more straightforward once we kind of get the algorithm piece of it down.
Curious about your specific experiences working with early stage founders on product development. And we talked about, you know, founders feeling spread thin, and obviously in those early stages, you know, again, every marginal hour you're torn between raising money, developing the product, managing your team, building your team. Be curious to hear any sort of lessons you've learned about product development and how maybe it should look, or, you know, pointers you have about how it looks in the early stages.
Actually really excited. In the next couple of weeks here in Kansas City, I'm launching a product development bootcamp. It'll be 3 days and it'll be kind of touching on a little bit of this information. But I think the biggest thing that I've learned and what I've started to like provide education for is on two founders is really about like how do founders become more product focused. I think the biggest thing is the documentation. I think a lot of founders have ideas and they're thinking, and you know, when you're solo founder, you think about things and then you do them. You're not thinking about like, is the employee down the road going to know what's going on? Is the developer I'm bringing in going to understand where I'm coming from? So really having that kind of slow down and be like, okay, like how do I best document? What is the problem I'm solving? What does the solution look like? And really trying to figure out the best way to kind of articulate what are those documents. Part of what I've been doing a lot of now, I'm working on this bootcamp and some of the curriculum is really providing that lens of like, when you have the problem, a lot of founders kind of skip over that. And they're like, oh, I've found a problem, but I have a solution and now I'm going to build the solution. It's going to be epic. And it's going to be amazing. But thinking more about user experience and thinking more about product, it's like always comes back to the problem and always comes back to the users. So really creating documents that are focusing on like, here is what I think the problem is. Here is how a user walks through the problem. Thinking about what kind of users are they? Are, you know, like how do you create personas for who are you building this for? Really kind of making the discernment against evidence-based. I know that this person is, I don't know, goes on Facebook every day and is, you know, constantly in social media versus assumptions you're making about a person and knowing what is an assumption and what is something you actually know and really documenting a lot of that kind of unconscious assumptions and hypotheses you're making and then really making a concerted effort to then test out those hypotheses and are they actually validated? Did you actually figure out the answer to that question or to that assumption you've made? So a lot of it is a little bit of that's kind of slow down and really being able to write out, what are you doing? What are you thinking? What have you assumed? What kind of data did you gather? How does that data then help interpret to a hypothesis? So that's been, I think, the biggest thing that I've realized and if now trying to figure out the best way to package it up and teach founders about it, is that a lot of it is the documentation. And it's really important in the early stages as you're thinking about what can I give to developers and what can I give to a development agency that will help them concretely understand what I'm building. They'll be able to budget it better. They'll be able to think about the experience that you're creating for a user better. And then post that MVP or post that initial launch, how do you continue to build and learn in that lean startup model that is taking in hypotheses and thinking about how do I best test features? How do I best test products? And how do I make sure that I am now operating in a space that I know what I know? And I'm not just guessing and I'm not just making assumptions. And how do you then build the best product that your customers are looking for?
You mentioned documentation and kind of how you obviously started the product development bootcamp. So I'd be curious to hear any predictions you have about how you see product development evolving, especially in the early stage startup ecosystem, and how those ecosystems are starting to think or behave differently when it comes to product development. What do you see on the horizon there?
I'm actually reading a book about trend-driven innovation, which was written a few years ago. But it's really interesting because I think, and I felt that on a lot of the tools that we have out now, it's really easy to build without it being custom. And I think that's probably the biggest trend I feel like hopefully will continue to move forward, is this understanding that like custom code can be your long-term business solution, because it kind of has to be. If you're building things and you're, you know, getting funding, you kind of have to have 100% ownership of what you're building. But in the early stages, you don't need that. And I think that that's something that trips people up, is that they're trying to get from zero to I have 100% ownership. And really with some of those trends, like you can build using existing products. Like you don't need to build and make code bases right now, because there's so many tools coming out and everything's new and shiny and better. There's probably a tool already out there that can do something similar to what you're hoping to build in the future. And so really trying to build and create and provide process to customers in a way that it's not, you're not building for a year, you're building for a month and you're putting out there and you're getting feedback, is what I'm hoping that this trends as we move forward and there's a little bit more understanding and education around, you know, what is tech and how does custom code work? And, you know, what is technology? And thinking about like, okay, I don't need everything to be tech focused right now. I'm just trying to solve a problem. And so how do I solve this problem and give it to people and, you know, get feedback and iterate on it next?
One final question before we move to the lightning rounds. Just curious to hear any stories you have about, you know, success cases, people you've coached and work with, startup founders that you've helped along their journey. I would love to just, yeah, hear a human story about what you've seen in the coaching world.
One of the founders that I think about a lot, as she comes on my timeline sometimes on LinkedIn, is a female founder who I met through one of those co-founding, like find your co-founder sites. And I was really on there to be kind of like an anti-co-founder, but I had a few people reach out to me who, you know, were like, hey, like I saw your background, I'm really interested to learn more. And like, I'm looking for a co-founder. And so one founder in particular, she, I believe, was a product person, didn't necessarily have a software development background, but, you know, was in the world of tech. And she was building a fitness platform. And we chatted a little bit about kind of what she has already done. She had already done wireframes and already kind of had the understanding of like what she was trying to build now and what she was trying to build in the future. She was like, oh, you know, like I've talked to an investor, I've talked to other entrepreneurs, and they're telling me that I need a tech co-founder. So I'm on here on this platform, you know, trying to find a tech co-founder. And within that conversation, I was like, actually, I think you're probably technical enough. Like you understand product, like you don't necessarily need the software development background to be able to build what you're trying to build. So basically I was like, you don't need me. I don't think you need anybody really at this point. Like there's different ways that you can get to where you're trying to go. And without it being, you know, hiring, you're trying to find a second person on your team. So I think it was a great conversation. We connected on LinkedIn about a year. It's about 6 to 9 months later, she had posted that her first app was in the App Store. Her small team was growing. And it was just like exciting to see that like she kind of taken, not to say that I I don't know how much credit I can take, but to at least see that she like really moved forward with that and that it has now become an app and, you know, continues to move forward. Because I think a lot of the interesting thing about early stage startups is that, you know, people pop up and they have a great idea and then, you know, they disappear and you don't see them again, don't know what happens. And so to really see people that I've chatted to 9 months ago, a year ago, pop back up and they're like, hey, I have an app, or hey, you know, we're doing beta testing and, you know, would love to have, you know, people on the app is just like really exciting to see that they continue to move forward and they, you know, hurdled over those roadblocks and they're launching and they're, you know, being successful in whatever form that takes.
You know, what motivates you in your day to day, like, you know, that's what you essentially became the startup pioneer for, you know, seeing that kind of those, you know, awesome results.
I think it's interesting and exciting to have been a person who had like no startup understanding, like jump into the startup ecosystem and through various like talking to founders and like getting that experience. Like I now feel very like strong in my understanding and in my like abilities to help founders, to, you know, help parts of the ecosystem. And it's not just, you know, impacting founders, but it's also providing a different lens of, you know, being in the ecosystem. And now that I'm a founder now, it's interesting because at one point I was like, I don't need to be a founder. Like I could just be someone who's in the ecosystem working and impacting founders and building communities and have that be the journey that I'm taking. But now it's kind of taken this interesting turn and it's still really interesting to see other founders and, you know, communicating with other communities and ecosystems and still letting this journey kind of play out the way that it's playing out, but it being unique in itself. And there is some success in this and it's, you know, exciting to just be in here and see what else I can learn and take from it.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a really good job. We'll definitely continue to watch this space.
Thank you.
Just moving ourselves into the lightning round now, just a few quick fire questions for you, hopefully a little more fun and lighter than solving the ultimate problems of VC startup world. But this would be really interested to hear this actually, you know, as a founder and someone who works with a lot of startups, you know, what would you say is the most game-changing sort of tech product you've come across slash, you know, what's the tech stack you're working with, you know, based on all the tools you've come across on day to day?
Ooh, I don't know about what is the most innovative, epic thing, but it is always for me, just like context switching tools is the thing right now that I'm like on the hunt for. I recently come across Stack. I am doing part-time a few different things. We didn't touch on this because I don't necessarily touch on it a lot, but I have like three or four different roles I'm currently juggling and they all use different emails. And so there's different logins for things. I have like five Gmail accounts and all of those Gmails have different logins. And so I've been on the hunt for a software that allows me to like context switch easily enough that is not just like me opening 16 different tabs with all of the different things. And so Stack has been one of those that has allowed me to switch between accounts and switch between apps like Gmail, for example, that allow me to like be logged in multiple places. And so that's probably been the biggest game changer. The products I use are really just like Google Drive a bunch. At base, we use Catalog, which allows for kind of a lot of that progress updates and adding resources and things like that. And that's been helpful because it's like I document something and then I like go in there and I'm like, here's this document I created. And if you don't read all of it, like here's the TLDR version. So just really allowing that ability to kind of context switch and do a bunch of different things at the same time without thinking about logins and do I have access to this and am I in this right email and all of that, that kind of gets confusing.
I find myself in a very similar situation where I have and my solution is to have 20 tabs open. So definitely check Stack out. And again, I'm super interested to know your view on this because you have a very unique point of view on it. What's one problem that tech can't solve for and why?
I think really the human element of things is something that tech is never going to be able to solve. I think a little bit about AI and machine learning and all of that. And I went to a talk a few years ago about how we are kind of developing AI to almost kind of have like, I am the human overlord and you AI are the, I don't want to say slave. There's another word that I can think of that I can't think of right now, but that like plebe that is just doing all the work. And I just like check off a box because, you know, the AI is doing everything for you. I mean, I think so much of what products are and so much of what technology is to make humans better. For us, we like can't really lose the human element of some of that technology. So really in this talk, it was a lot about like how you and an AI can kind of work together instead of it being like AI is the thing that does it and I'm just here doing other things and finding a way to continue to inject empathy and human understanding into the technology we're building and allow those things to be hand in hand versus it really just be like everything has to be unbiased and, you know, all of it's black and white, because that's never going to happen because humans have built AIs. So there's always going to be that in anyways. So really kind of removing that like need for it to be like cold, hard computers are doing everything for us and really making it probably more empathetic in the way that we approach technology.
Related follow-up, we like to, is a Tech for Good podcast, but we like to ask questions about tech for bad. So just curious about what you've seen out there as the evilest application of tech out in the wilderness.
I'm going to take a weird approach to it because I also couldn't think of anything, but the thing that like really annoys me at this point is like subscription models. And I'm going to say this and preface it that like, I understand that subscription models are revenue generation. And like, I understand from that product standpoint, but it like really annoys me that like, we've got to pay multiple subscriptions for like tools we're using that are not giving us like value, like month over month, like there's not additions to that value. So for example, to-do lists are another thing that I'm always like trying to find. And like for to just have the simple, you know, you write elements down, you tag them in certain groups and you maybe are using the same three or four features, but to pay a subscription fee for something that is not changed, you know, bug fixes, get it. But like you're not adding new features every month, but I'm paying a monthly subscription fee and I've got to pay this monthly subscription fee for the rest of my life if I have to continue to use this product is the thing that like really irks me. And I really just want us to go back to like flat rate fees and like, you know, lifetime value and things like that, because I don't know how we're going to continue to pay hundreds of dollars a month, you know, for things we're using and are integrated into our daily lives.
That's the first time we've ever had that answer. That's a super interesting one.
It kind of blows up a lot of the SaaS business model as well. Like, you know, so that's, wow. For someone who works so deeply with a lot of SaaS founders, that's a fascinating answer.
People are going to be really angry at me.
You're going to get our first email.
I was going to say, hopefully some of your clients listen to this podcast.
On to the next question. This one, I guess, you'll have to kind of really think about how you phrase this, because I know you are working on tech products. So you don't want to give away any of your trade secrets. You know, if you could dream up a new tech product, what would be the problem it would solve and why?
This is something that I have had thoughts about prior to Base Ventures, but it is like heavy tech and I don't know that I have the capacity to deal with it. But if I could just like dream it up and it just like magically appears, it would probably be version control for documents and for like tech that doesn't already have version control embedded into it. That is the thing that it's interesting coming from a software development background and then moving into more of a business side of things. It kind of blows my mind that we don't have an easy way to version documents like we have to version code, because I think there's a lot of great applications, I think, especially for startup founders, where you're consistently iterating, you're having epiphanies, you're trying to create documents and they're trying to be living documents. But I have not found a tool out there currently that allows that like living documentation space to live in a software. It almost has to be like a manual process you're creating to make sure that you're versioning things. So there's so many applications of like GitHub that other than adding your documents into GitHub, I think would be like really great for Google Docs or like low code tools, for example, like Bubble and things like that, that would allow you to version stuff and kind of like GitHub would allow you to kind of like cherry pick changes and move them into development and production environments and just make that whole documentation long-term documentation process way easier.
It's funny that you mentioned version control. We actually have a client who's working on this very thing in the SaaS space as well. So check out Typed, they're called. But it's like another sort of knowledge management tool that you can actually pile on top of, Google Docs and some of the other systems you're using to help you with things like version control and actually connecting it with stuff your colleagues are working on and stuff you worked on in the past that maybe you've forgotten about and things like that. So really like a tool for synthesis and just like a beefed up, way to organize your thoughts and yourself. So
perfect. I'm glad that I said that. And there's already someone out there who's doing.
Fair warning. I think it's a subscription model. So you're going to have to watch out.
As long as they're giving me more value every month, I'm okay.
You can go to AppSumo right now and buy a lifetime deal for $150. So just throwing it out there. We are promoting that deal a lot this week. So I'm really, really in the weeds with this client.
Perfect.
Solves. No subscription necessary. Cool. Round us out with the last two questions of the lightning round here. Thanks for hanging on with us, Charlotte. Just curious about your take on the tech space in general, and then specifically, we like to focus on tech for good. Any predictions you see for like the remainder of 2022 that you'd like to share with the audience? What do you see coming down the pipe?
I don't know. I'm going to say what I hope comes in. I think with a lot of what's happening right now with data and, again, Supreme Court. And I was just talking about this with my sister about how there's so much about like data breaches and like software that are, handing over data to law enforcement and things like that. And so much of what I've seen kind of come out of it is that people are like, stop using the app, like don't use this app. And I'm like, it's already kind of too late at this point. Like so many applications have our data and are probably already selling our data that like getting off of one of those apps, like you're kind of already screwed. I'm hoping that as we kind of continue to move through 2022, that the biggest thing is that we're still thinking about ethical concerns around data and the products that we're building. I think that that's starting to be something that is already existing. So I hope that as we continue to be in this environment, it continues to be a really like high stakes. Like, how do we make sure that our data is safe? How do we make sure that users understand what we're using the data for, that we're being a little bit more transparent? And then the second thing is like, as I think a user and thinking about tech and knowing that you're, unknowingly giving your data away, I'm thinking about how to best, like protect yourself without it being about like, do I use the data? Do I not? I was telling my sister, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this, like, apps giving away my data, except like lie. Like, I'm just going to start lying because like, if, this data is going to be used against me, like, how do they know that I was, completely telling the truth? So I think that there's other ways to think about using tech and it being great for you. But also knowing that like, if this does, get out and, it's hacked or people are just freely giving it away, like, how can I protect myself against it? That is not just like me, like trying to migrate away from technology at this point.
Yeah, along those lines, one of my favorite things to do is whenever I have those pesky like airport or hotel like login forms you need to do, I always log in as Pablo Escobar. And apologies to whoever owns the email address, pescobar@gmail.com. It's clearly a valid email address and they're just getting all of my airport and hotel internet logins. But I just, I'm just like, you don't need all this. You don't need my birthday at this standard hotel in London to like log in. It's just silly. So yeah, apologies to the actual Pablo Escobar out there.
It's particularly egregious when it's like an airport Wi-Fi and it's like, there's no world in which you need to know what day I was born and send me birthday wishes like Heathrow Airport. I don't want a birthday card from Heathrow Airport.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Final question we like to close with, and again, as a Tech for Good podcast, we like to ask about, this dynamic in the tech world of balancing, obviously you need to earn a profit, earn a living, support yourself, support your family, but then also you want to do good. And that obviously shines through in the work you're doing with coaching founders and just supporting them with lots of empathy. So how have you balanced those two sort of ends of things, profit and purpose in your career, Charlotte?
I haven't done a really good job about balancing it. Because I have so much empathy for founders and people who are in the ecosystem that kind of purpose has kind of overwhelmed my like thought process around profit. I right now am thinking about more moving towards getting a full-time job and trying to prioritize the profit side of it. So I think for right now, it's really just about knowing that I like working with people and I like impacting founders. And instead of trying to profit from the person that I am impacting, figure out a way to provide value to an organization that is also kind of providing that value. I guess it's kind of like a profit shift. And that's really what has taken me kind of away from consulting, was realizing that, you know, the people that I really wanted to help and people that I really felt like I was making an impact for didn't necessarily have the funds it would take for me to be a consultant on their team. And so now it's really been like, okay, what are the organizations that are working and with founders who are providing founder resources that are looking for new and interesting ways to help impact large groups of founders? How can I join their team, get paid to do it, and still be impactful in the work that I'm doing?
Any final thoughts from either of you before we close out here?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me. This was a really great conversation.
This has been another episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, joined by my co-founder, William Gatsby Pete, and an amazing guest today, startup journey pioneer and self-professed startup nerd, and also co-founder and CTO of Base Ventures, Charlotte Clark.
Such a pleasure having you on, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining, Charlotte.